previously on Unsolved.
There were calls all over the place. We got calls from like Florida that they saw her. You know, it was just, that's what really kills your investigation. Because unless you got a contact to go down to Florida, and then you go down there and it's like, well, what are we looking for? You know, well, somebody claimed they saw her at a gas station. It was like, well.
So I remember calling Milwaukee Police Department and talking to somebody. And I also remember talking to a man named Steve Spingola over email. And kind of both of them told me the same things. And they said that they believed that Alexis was in a landfill, but they couldn't prove it.
From USA Today and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, this is Unsolved Season 4, A Missing Girl, A Search for Truth. I'm Gina Barton. Chapter 5, A Package from Ohio. In 2016, 14 years after Alexis Patterson disappeared, a man in Ohio was trying to dig up some dirt that would help him get custody of his young son during a contentious divorce. As part of his research, he came across a poster of Alexis from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. When he saw the age-progressed image of what Alexis might look like at 21, he did a double take. The woman on the poster looked a lot like his soon-to-be ex-wife, a woman who had told him some very strange stories about her past. Crocker Stevenson was working at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel at the time, and he had recently covered the sentencing of Alexis's biological father on charges that he had abused one of her half-sisters. Not long after the story ran, Crocker got a package from the Ohio man, whose name was Josh. The package was full of pictures of Josh's estranged wife, Lisa, and her daughter, Josh's stepdaughter. Not only did Lisa resemble the age-progressed photo of Alexis, her daughter bore a striking resemblance to the photo of Alexis as a kid. In his letter to Crocker, Josh said he was convinced that Lisa could actually be Alexis. Josh lives in the tiny town of Bryan, Ohio. He didn't want to talk to me, for reasons that will become clear later. For those same reasons, I'm not going to use his last name, or Lisa's. But as the story unfolded 7 years ago, Josh sat down for several interviews with Crocker, who's retired now.
I had been a journalist for 35 years. I had seen some really weird things that you thought would not possibly be true. And so it would just be arrogant to dismiss it. I was excited to go down there just to see what this was all about.
When Crocker got to Ohio, Josh told him all about his relationship with Lisa. He first saw her in 2007 while he was playing basketball with a group of guys. Lisa was dating one of them, and she had brought her baby daughter to watch the game. Josh told Crocker he didn't see Lisa again for several months.
The following spring is when I first met her and actually became acquainted with her. She wasn't with the guy. She just had the baby. And me and my friends were the only ones there. And she walked to the park with the child and watched us play. And when we were done and got ready to leave, she approached me and asked for my phone number.
Lisa told Josh she had emigrated from Belize with her mother, Shirley, and stepfather, Lincoln. They had lived in California and Michigan before settling in Ohio, near the Indiana border. Josh was immediately taken with Lisa, but they didn't start dating right away.
I actually had to go to rehab. I had already been informed and put on a waiting list, knew when I was going. So I informed Lisa of this, and we stayed in contact for the 6 months that I was in rehab. And in the time I was in rehab, we could talk on the phone for the first month or so before she was allowed to actually write me a letter.
Josh told Crocker that when Lisa finally did write, she used a fake last name.
And she said she wasn't allowed to write me a letter or send me any money because Lincoln wouldn't let her write me because he was afraid that it would get her in trouble with her paperwork situation, with her citizenship. So when she did write me, she wrote me as Lisa Bradley. She said Bradley was one of her friends from when she lived in California when she was little.
When Josh got out of rehab, he moved in with his dad. So did Lisa and her baby daughter. Josh said Lisa never gave him a lot of details about her background.
I mean, her stories just basically involved her being, like I said, 8 to 10 years old in Belize, going to school, having to walk to school, having to wash their clothes in the river and having to worry about alligators, and they didn't have sewers.
He says Lisa didn't have any photos of herself as a child, either in Belize or when she first moved to the United States.
Nothing. No infant pictures, no first steps, no pictures in the diaper, no kindergarten, no first grade, no nothing.
She also didn't have any pictures of herself during her first pregnancy. Josh says she told him all that stuff must have been lost in one of her family's moves. In 2009, Lisa got pregnant again.
After we found out that she was pregnant, my mother and my stepfather were rather religious growing up, very strict. And they kind of instilled it into me that I'm not supposed to have a child out of wedlock. So I basically told Lisa that I didn't really have a choice, we're going to get married.
As they planned their wedding, Josh found out Lisa didn't have a birth certificate.
Lincoln informed us that we had to mail something to someone in Belize. We had to mail money and a form and stuff to Belize. So we went through an attorney and mailed this form and this money to Belize. And, you know, over a 6 to 8 week period, it got lost. And it was a struggle. And finally, we got a birth certificate for Lisa.
Josh says something else odd happened after the wedding when they were moving out of his father's house and into their own place.
When we were pulling out her belongings, multiple IDs fell out of a box. They had her picture with different, I mean, like real non-American name. You know, like it was something off the wall.
Lisa's explanation for why she had so many fake IDs didn't make a lot of sense to Josh.
She told me when I was in rehab that she went to Detroit and to Flint and did door-to-door sales for electric and telecommunications. Like, she tried to get people to sign up with their electric company or their telephone service, and she would receive a commission. But it was for an Arabic guy named Muhammad, and she had to use different identities.
Before Josh contacted Crocker, his new fiance, Sasha, had sent an email with the same photos of Lisa and her daughter to the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Department. An investigator there promised to pass it along to the Milwaukee police, but Josh never heard back. Crocker made some follow-up calls.
I tried to get a beat from the police department. Is this possible? The police department said it was just a very vague response. The sheriff's department also very vague response.
Crocker was left to evaluate Josh's evidence with no help from law enforcement. Initially, he considered the possibility that Josh and Sasha had made up the whole story to discredit Lisa in court and get custody of his son.
My first conversation with Josh raised a number of red flags. One is that the woman that he believed was Alexis was his ex-wife, that they had a child and that they shared, and that there might be some sort of custody issue. Josh was preparing to get remarried, and his fiance was also part of this, the letter and the effort to bring this woman to light.
There was also an age problem. Lisa's birth certificate from Belize said she was 21 when she married Josh. Alexis would have been 7 years younger.
Alexa would have had been 14 when he married her, according to his timeline. That was possible, totally possible. But again, a red flag.
On the other hand, Alexis and Lisa had a lot of distinguishing characteristics that matched. Remember the scar under Alexis's eye and the bump on her finger that I told you about in episode 1? Lisa had both of those.
I asked, are there any other characteristics besides the scar and the finger?
Josh told Crocker there was something else, something that had never been released to the public and wasn't on the missing poster of Alexis.
My ex-wife has a birthmark on her right buttocks.
Before he left Ohio, Crocker called Alexis's mother back in Milwaukee and convinced Josh to talk with her. Ayanna told me Josh didn't want to talk to her at first.
He said, the only way I'll talk to you if you tell me one thing that nobody knows about Alexis. And I told him about her birthmark and where it's at. You have to be her husband or her boyfriend to know where her birthmark is. And that's when he said, oh my God, oh my God.
Anna was really galvanized because this was some information that just wasn't in the public eye, and it was confirmation to her that this was Alexis.
Ayanna did her own research, finding out everything she could about Lisa online and scrutinizing her photos on social media. She spotted more and more features that reminded her of Alexis. With each one, her belief that Lisa was her missing daughter grew stronger.
If you look at Alexis' gums like this, she has like a dark mark on her gum. I know how she got it because her teeth overlapped, okay? And it was just, and then she has like a little speck on her tooth because it was growing in.
The list of parallels Ayanna saw between Lisa and Alexis went on and on. Lisa's children have the same names as two of Alexis's closest cousins. Even Lisa herself has the same name as one of Ayanna's favorite aunts. Pictures on Facebook showed Lisa with similar outfits and hairstyles to those Ayanna had posted of herself. To Josh, the idea that Lisa could be Alexis explained a lot, like why Lisa never mentioned an extended family and didn't seem close with anyone.
So to find these things out and to know that it could be somebody else's child, it explains why Lisa had no family, why she had no cousins, why she had no relatives, why she had no friends, why she had nobody to talk to. Explains everything.
But there was one very important person who didn't share those views. Lisa. Crocker talked to her back in 2016.
I called Josh's ex-wife, and who was like, you are ruining my life. Like, by now, things had slipped out. I think a TV station from Milwaukee had gone down there. There were TV trucks camped out in front of her house. She was furious. And she said, this is absolutely ridiculous. This whole idea is ridiculous. So this is Josh just trying to hurt me. Her fiance or husband, I forgot which, got on the phone, and he was really, really angry. And he said, you're ruining our lives. We're afraid for our children. We're afraid to go outside. We're private people. We're suddenly, you know, in the spotlight. Well, we hadn't even written a story yet.
But Crocker still thought Lisa could be Alexis. If the couple Lisa knew as her mother and stepfather had kidnapped her, maybe she was covering for them. Or maybe she genuinely didn't remember being abducted from Milwaukee when she was 7 and given a new identity.
You know, that's possible. That's really possible. I mean, the birthmark thing, you know, that really, I did not expect that. And so, and who knows what, if say this was Alexis, and she doesn't have a memory of what happened before 10, Alexis was 7 when she vanished. Who knows what is buried in her, what is denied in her, who knows what is going on in this person's life.
We'll have more after the break. On all the cop shows, and on CSI, the one about crime scene investigators, DNA is an easy answer to mysteries like this. The scientists get a sample, they put it into a machine, and ta-da, the facts are known. The episode ends with a happy reunion. In this case, Lisa did agree to give a DNA sample. But because this is real life, there was still all kinds of confusion. Part of the problem was an issue that has come up a lot in crime stories I've covered. Jurisdiction. In Milwaukee, there's a city police department and a county sheriff's department. Alexis's case fell squarely to the police department, except for one thing. The mobile command post, which was the center of all the efforts to find her in the early days after her disappearance, was in Washington Park. The park was smack in the middle of Alexis's neighborhood, within a mile of both her home and her school. But it was a county park, which means it fell under the authority of the sheriff's department. That might not have been a problem, except for one thing. The sheriff at the time was none other than David Clark, who rose to fame as a right-wing pundit, even though he always ran for sheriff as a Democrat. Clark, known for his cowboy hat and nicknamed America's Sheriff, went on to become a high-profile supporter of Donald Trump. Here's a clip from his speech at the 2016 Republican National Convention.
Sadly, for a growing number of communities, the sense of safety that many of us once took for granted has been shattered. What we witnessed in Ferguson, in Baltimore, and Baton Rouge was a collapse of the social order. So many of the actions of the Occupy movement and Black Lives Matter transcends peaceful protest and violates the code of conduct we rely on. I call it anarchy.
Before he became Milwaukee County Sheriff, Clark, who is Black, was a homicide detective and then a captain at the city police department. There were rumors at the time that he was next in line for the chief's job. But instead, he became sheriff in March 2002. He was appointed by a Republican governor, Scott McCallum, after the previous sheriff resigned. Clark hadn't even been on the job 2 months when Alexis disappeared. And even though the case wasn't technically his to investigate, he got very involved. And there was some friction between him and his former boss, Milwaukee's city police chief, Arthur Jones. In the early days of the investigation, no one really saw that as a problem. James Causey, who covered the case for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and whom you heard talking about race relations in the city in episode 3, remembers it this way.
One thing with our sheriff, David Clark, he butt heads with a lot of people. It was different because the command post was set up at the park and the sheriff departments ran the parks. And so that's where the command post was. The police department runs this, city streets and all those kind of things. So it was a little bit of conflict between who's in charge and at what time the press conferences were going to be held. It was a little bit of that, but I don't think in general people really got caught up in that part. It was mostly, let's find this little girl. Let's get to the bottom of this.
Steve Spingola, the retired supervisor who worked on Alexis's case at the beginning, felt the same way.
I really don't think it impacted the outcome of this investigation. I really don't.
But by 2016, things had changed. Clark had stopped downplaying his right-wing tendencies, and people were starting to resent the fact that he kept running for sheriff as a Democrat when his beliefs and public statements aligned so closely with the far right. Still, Clark kept attention focused on Alexis's case. For years, he marked the anniversary of her disappearance by laying a wreath at her school. Arthur Jones eventually stepped down as police chief, but Clark didn't get along any better with the new chief.
The police department seemed to be at loggerheads with the sheriff's department. I mean, it was just like every time you talk to a different person at either the sheriff's department or the police department, they weren't in lockstep. They felt, if not in competition, more like they were just ignored them. Like the sheriff's department was like, the police department doesn't know what they're doing. We've been following this. And the police department was basically the same. The sheriff's department doesn't know what they're doing. We're following this.
That's the backdrop for the conflict that arose after Ayanna found out about Lisa in Ohio. She called one of the cold case investigators assigned to Alexis's case, Eric Villarreal.
I said, Eric. I said, I found my daughter, Eric. I found my daughter. He said, that's not your daughter, Ayanna. That's not your daughter.
So Ayanna called the sheriff's department, and Sheriff Clark agreed to send a deputy to Ohio to swab Lisa's cheek for a DNA sample.
I called Eric Villarreal, the detective on Alexis's case, and I said, that's okay, Eric, you don't have to swab. You don't have to go and take her DNA, because the Milwaukee Sheriff's Department went down there to take her DNA.
But when the sheriff's deputy got there, Lisa wouldn't let him swab her cheek.
The sheriff's department was not able to swab her because Bryan, Ohio claimed that they took her DNA already.
According to a report I obtained from the Bryan Police Department, an officer there swabbed Lisa's cheek at the request of the Milwaukee police. Then the Ohio officer packaged up the sample and sent it to Wisconsin via FedEx. Ayanna didn't buy the Milwaukee detective's explanation for why he didn't go down to Ohio to get the DNA from Lisa himself. After all, the police had traveled around the country looking for Alexis.
He told me that that was against his jurisdiction, so he wasn't able to go down there and swab her. And I said, that's bull crap, because when they said she was in Louisiana, you guys flew down there. When they said she was in Atlanta, you flew there. When they said she was in Chicago, you flew there.
Crocker also thinks something strange was going on with the whole DNA situation.
My understanding was that it was the Milwaukee Sheriff's Department that went down and got a DNA sample. But then I also was told that it was the local Sheriff's Department that got a DNA sample. And then I was also told that it was the Milwaukee Police Department that got a DNA sample, all from the ex-wife. I don't know.
In any case, getting the results would take weeks, if not longer. In the meantime, Ayanna and Josh hatched a plan of their own.
So now we're waiting for the DNA. And Ayanna is like, I don't trust the police department. I don't trust the sheriff's department. I don't trust the state crime lab. We have a boy that would share my DNA if he's my grandson. Bring him up and I will meet him. We can do a DNA test here and see if this is my grandchild.
So that's what they did. Josh and his new fiance, Sasha, brought the son he shared with Lisa to Milwaukee. The boy was 6 years old at the time. Crocker was there when they arrived, and he remembers that day clearly.
So they didn't have permission to take that child out of state. So they secreted him up here so that he could meet possibly his grandmother, that they could take a DNA sample from him and do their own DNA testing. So they pull up in front of Ayanna's house. They get out. They go up to the door. They're very, they're just a little bit, a little scared, I think. The door opens. Ayanna's just like, come in. There's food. And just basically, it's joyful. It's a joyful meeting. Even if this woman in Bryan, Ohio, is Alexis and won't admit it or understand it, for Ayanna, this is like, how could this be a better ending to this story? I mean, what were the options? That she's sex trafficked somewhere out in Vegas, or that she's dead, or that she's died terribly, or that she's a young woman living in Bryan, Ohio with children. No matter how Ayanna wanted to look at it, this was a good thing.
I asked Ayanna what it was like to meet this little boy, who she thought could be her grandson.
I just could not believe it. And I just kept looking at him. He looked just like Alexis. He just lighter like me. And I just kept looking at him like, and I couldn't believe it. He was just on me, just laying on me, just like, he was just all over me. Like he knew me. It's like he knew who I was. And he looked me in my face like this. And he was just staring at me. And then he had his arm around me. And his daddy said, she looked like your mom? And he said, yes. He knew I looked like his mama. He knew that I looked like his mother. He knew it. It's like he knew me already. He came. He laid on me. He ate pizza. He ate ice cream. He ate drunk soda. He did everything. I didn't even want to give him no pizza, though, because I don't eat that stuff. But he that's what he liked. So I wanted to give him. I got him Ninja Turtle stickers, just everything. I went above and beyond for him.
Using an at-home DNA test marketed to potential grandparents, Ayanna and Josh swabbed their own cheeks and then that of the little boy. They packaged the samples and sent them off to a commercial lab. Ayanna believed it would be just a matter of time before science confirmed what she already knew in her heart. So she was living in this middle ground, happy that she believed her daughter was alive, yet unable to spend time with her. I asked Ayanna what that was like.
Ugh. That's hard right there. Excuse me for 1 second. I said I wasn't gonna cry. That question right there. That's hard. Knowing that she alive. Knowing that she breathing. Knowing that I've been waiting all these years to get my daughter. And I find out that she alive. And well and breathing with kids. Wonderful mother. Wonderful mother. And I can't have her. And I know that she mine.
Next time on Unsolved.
I don't understand why you guys keep going all over the place.
Oh, so I'm really sorry to disturb you.
No, that's not your place to do that. You went to Lisa's house. You went to her boyfriend's house. Why are you doing this?
Because there's still...
Because there's nothing.
Unsolved is written and produced by me, Gina Barton. Ashley Luthern of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel assisted with reporting this season. Our sound engineer is Bill Schultz. Editors are Amy Pyle and Greg Borowski. Our theme music was composed by Evan Johnson. The clip of David Clark you heard in this episode came from C-SPAN. For more on Alexis's case, or to sign up for our newsletter, visit usatoday.com/unsolved. My team's investigation into disparities in missing children's cases can be found at missing.usatoday.com.